Specifically. And I am going to be taking my cues from a notion that the feminist art historian Sandra Langer brought forward, an idea of old visions, new frontiers, a contrast between tradition and contemporary developments. And in looking at the work of African-American artists from that perspective, one of the things that I began to see is that it gave me a peculiarly useful, I think, kind of vantage point, too, on the parallels and differences between the practice of black women in particular and other American women artists. So I'm hoping that you'll, too, be able to see that here. Let me just get the remotes here. Oops. I just crushed. This afternoon, I want to address the theme of old visions, new frontiers, with respect to the work of American-born black women artists. Active in the fine arts for over a century, Afro-American women have produced a unique cultural legacy. Yet, theirs is a history that, to a great extent, consists of tantalizing fragments. A territory that has languished in art historical neglect, the story of black women's participation in the visual arts remains largely untold. And lacking a verifiable past, the art of contemporary black women is easily mistaken for a historical anomaly. All too often, as a result, work by contemporary black women is viewed as being divorced from familiar aesthetic and social origins, leaving the peculiar impression that their race and gender somehow magically erased the effects of art school training, while their art school training somehow severed all ethnic group and gender-based ties. In fact, the complexity of African-American women artists' responses to the aesthetic models and social conditions of their time probably accounts for the bewildering diversity of their products. During the 1980s, for example, black women have painted in idioms as unlike as those of Howard Ina Pendel, here on the left, and Renee Green, here on the right. Pendel's 1982-83 Hane no Tambo, Japan, is a large 5'9" by 12'5" unstretched canvas in which slim canvas strips have been patiently sewn together and coated with acrylic paint. I'll show you the detail. Then, tiny paper dots and photo transfer images are embedded in the viscous surface. Inspired by a year-long stay in Japan, the painting combines a formal sensuousness and symbolic reticence that is characteristic of this artist's work. In contrast, Green's Empire No. 4, a 1985 painting, and she has informed me recently that her work now is very, very different, uses the calculatedly crude vocabulary of spikehead expressionism to broadcast its anti-imperialist message loud and clear. Oops. In sculpture, the 1980s saw such artists as Marin Hassinger, here on the left, and Renee Stout, on the right, moving in opposite stylistic directions. Executed in 1989, Hassinger's reign continues her over a decade-long use of wire rope to create elegantly reductive drawings in space that evoke natural phenomena. Stout, a Washington, D.C.-based artist, on the other hand, is a relative newcomer. Her 1988 The Guardian of the Medicine Boxes employs figurative imagery and a potent combination of artist-made and recycled objects to suggest spiritual abundance. Throughout the decade, African-American women have explored a dazzling variety of media and forms. Los Angeles's veteran collage, assemblage, and installation artist, Betty Saar, whose work you're seeing here on the left, has mined the visual poetry of computer circuitry and microchips, for example, in such works as her 1988 Lost Dimensions of Time. In New York, meanwhile, Candace Hill was busy experimenting with photographic techniques in pursuit of a fascination with linguistically based post-structuralist theory. Hill's use of multiple exposures in work like 1984, Men, When, Will, End, mirrors the indeterminate, multi-referential nature of signs. At the same time, Martha Jackson Jarvis, who, like Renee Stout, resides in Washington, D.C., has been putting one of the world's oldest art materials, ceramic clay, to stunning new uses. The Gathering was a 1988 room-size installation in which Jackson Jarvis marked space and suggested opposing centrifugal forces with forms consisting of thousands of shards of glazed, fired clay. Another 1988 installation, Adrian Piper's Cornered, seemed worlds apart from Jackson Jarvis's evocation of the cosmos, however. The installation by Piper featured a video monitor that was stationed in a corner, apparently pinned there by an overturned conference table. Flanking the monitor, two birth certificates hung on adjacent walls. Dated 1911 and issued in West Virginia, they had belonged to the artist's late father. One declared him white. The other pronounced him an octoroon. In her on-screen videotaped performance, Piper invited viewers to consider the ramifications of a recent estimate that 80% of U.S. whites have some black ancestry. Given the immense variety of even this tiny sample of contemporary work by Afro-American women, it seems difficult to imagine what, aside from race and gender classifications, might link them in an historically meaningful way. This difficulty looms large as long as we are unwilling or unable to construct a history of African-American women's art. Once we start to fill in even a few of the record's many blanks, however, the situation changes. We have no evidence of black women working as fine artists prior to emancipation, but we know that the skills of slave craftswomen, primarily seamstresses and weavers, were highly valued. At times wittingly, at times unwittingly, Southern planters imported African craft traditions and techniques along with African bodies. Along the South Carolina-Georgia coast, especially in the area known as the Georgia Sea Islands, it was African know-how, as well as African resistance to malaria, that turned treacherous marshes into lucrative rice plantations. In addition to methods of cultivation, the region's African labor force supplied traditional implements, like the coiled grass rice banner seen at left in a photograph taken in South Carolina in 1908. The photograph at right, taken in Angola around 1929-30, shows our South Carolina subject's African sister creating a coiled grass basket that is the structural twin of the American rice banner. I'm showing you a detail of an American example here on the left. But the story of Afro-American functional as well as fine art, is a story of cultural hybridization. As we see in this turn-of-the-century photograph of a Charleston, South Carolina street vendor. Her two baskets are equipped with handles, signaling a European mode of design. But note that she bears one basket on her head, a typically African mode of transport. Harriet Powers's 1886 Bible quilt, here on the left, demonstrates a similar cross-cultural fluency. While its silhouetted forms are reminiscent of the famed appliqué cloths of the Fon people of what is now the Republic of Benin, its subject is strictly Judeo-Christian. A contemporary artist, whose work you've already seen today, who, like Powers, makes narrative quilts, Faith Ringgold, is the daughter of a Harlem fashion designer and great-granddaughter of a Florida slave quilt maker. Her 1986 The Color Purple quilt thus honors both a contemporary black feminist literary monument, Alice Walker's novel, and a black female artistic legacy embodied in the black quilt tradition. Documented activity by black women in the fine arts starts with the work of Mary Edmonia Lewis. Half Chippewa and half black, she is thought to have been born around 1845, perhaps in Ohio or near Albany, New York. Her most famous work, which you're seeing here, Forever Free, was sculpted in 1867 to commemorate the Emancipation Proclamation that decreed an official end to U.S. slavery. A part of the Harriet Hosmer Circle of American women artists in Rome when she executed the marble pier, Lewis had also been associated with white feminists before leaving the United States. Hence, it seems likely that the gender iconography of Forever Free, with its triumphant standing male who rests a paternalistic hand on the shoulder of the kneeling, supplicant female, was not fortuitous. With the adoption by Congress of the 14th Amendment in 1866, language limiting citizenship rights to males had been introduced into the U.S. Constitution for the first time. Seeing their own campaign for equality severely damaged by a piece of legislation that empowered blacks, women suffragists who had previously been staunch supporters of black civil rights were now staunchly opposed to a proposed 15th Amendment extending voting rights to black men. Given her strong feminist ties, Lewis may well have counted herself among those few black women who felt, as Sojourner Truth put it in an 1867 speech, and remember, 1867 is the year of this piece, that emancipation left, quote, slavery partly destroyed, not entirely, unquote. And we realize that if, quote, colored men get their rights and not colored women theirs, the colored men will be the masters over the women and it will be just as bad as it was before, unquote. That's Sojourner Truth. In addition to its black feminist overtones, Forever Free is the earliest extant fine artwork by an African American to represent the harsh facts of bondage. As such, it is the distinguished ancestor of works like Lois Mailou Jones's 1944 Mob Victim, here on the right, and Betty Saar's 1972 Is Jim Crow Really Dead?, a reference to the whole system of segregation. Works that illustrate black women artists' continued preoccupation with racial injustice. In her 1987 construction, Separate But Equal, Howardina Pindell, looks beyond American shores to focus on South Africa's apartheid system. erotica isn't a new interest for black women artists, though. Although the version you're seeing here on the left is undated, we know that Meta Vo Warwick Fuller modeled a plaster version of this subject, this one is in alabaster, Ethiopia Awakening, in 1914. In the 1980s, Lorraine O'Grady has produced a performance piece and a photographic ensemble, both entitled Nefertiti / Devonia Evangeline. I'm showing you one of the pairs of photographs from the entire ensemble, that pairs images of the ancient Egyptian queen and her family with the artist's dead sister, Devonia Evangeline, and her family. The work is at once a paean to the lost world of the pre-Cosby era black middle class, a meditation on female sibling and mother-daughter relationships, and a rebuttal of the myth that Egypt wasn't a black culture. Nancy Elizabeth Prophet's 1930 Congolese, here on the left, was one of the first works by an African-American to be purchased by the Whitney Museum of American Art. Stylistically a product of early 20th century academic realism, it seems light years apart from Catty's 1983 Investment, here on the right, a wall construction that borrows such traits of traditional African sculpture as the use of ceremonial fringes, polychrome, and rhythmic asymmetry. Among women painters, Lois Jones was one of the first to cull from the legacy of African sculpture, as we see here in her Les Fétiches, a canvas executed in Paris in 1938. By the late 1970s, black women artists like Sangin Ngudi and Marin Hassinger, and black male artists like David Hammons, all three of whom you see in the photograph on the right, were not only emulating African sculpture's static forms, but had begun taking on the African tradition of intermediate performance. Together, Ngudi, the central figure garbed in white, Hassinger, the white-veiled figure at rear right, and Hammonds, the staff bearer at left, performed ceremony for freeway fetishes beneath a Los Angeles freeway ramp in 1979. Racial oppression and African heritage, though, are by no means the only recurrent tropes in the history of African-American women's art. There is a deep, often mystical attachment to nature found in works as distinct from one another as the late Elma Thomas's Flowers of the Jefferson Memorial, an undated canvas from the early 1970s, and Jackie Holmes's 1979 Song from the Earth, a handmade paper and mixed media diptych, of which I'm showing you the right panel, that resembles a musical score. In Three Views of Mount Fuji, a 1982 collage construction, Howardina Pindell conflates interests in Japan's topography and a tradition of landscape painting in which Mount Fuji figures prominently. Paradoxically, Marin Hassinger takes us indoors to enjoy her version of the natural paradise. In Heaven, Hassinger lined the walls with rose leaves, sprayed the room with scent, and let the viewer take it from there. Jackie Holmes, with her Song from the Earth, isn't alone in demonstrating musical tendencies. Augusta Savage was the only black artist commissioned to produce a work for the 1939 World's Fair. Savage's The Harp took as its theme the so-called Negro National Anthem, James Weldon Johnson's lyric, Lift Every Voice and Sing. Modeled in plaster, this monumental chorus of black voices presided over the court of the Fair's Contemporary Arts Building. In her 1983 audience participation performance piece, Funk Lessons, Adrienne Piper sought to share the transcendent properties of a much scorned black working class cultural artifact, funk music and dance, with a non-black working class audience. In the process of instructing participants in the elements of music and the accompanying dance style, Piper aimed to put audience members in touch with some of the sources of their unconscious fears and anxieties about cultural difference. Finally, black women artists share a history of producing images of women. Such images include Edmonia Lewis's 1875 stature of Hagar, the Old Testament Egyptian slave who, like so many African American women, was forced to become her master's concubine, then victimized by a jealous mistress. They also include images of white women, like Annie E.A. Walker's 1896 pastel portrait, La Parisienne, right. Laura Wheeler Waring's 1927 oil portrait of Anna Washington Derry elicited praise for its creator's technical facility when it was exhibited in the first Harmon Foundation exhibition of work by black artists. Elizabeth Catlett's 1972 Mother and Child is one of this sculptor's countless images of black womanhood. By the mid-1970s, with her Family of Women series, Faith Ringgold was producing soft sculpture reminiscent of the elaborately appliqué costumes of the Igbo people of Nigeria's traditional maiden spirits. Barbara Chase Rabu seems to have also tuned into African female imagery when she created her 1974 bronze and silk cord Black Zanzibar Table. With its bronze folds and braided fringe, the 12-inch high sculpture resembles the turbaned head of an African woman with braided hair. On the other hand, in her 1985 Mamba Mambo, Alison Saar invokes the black diaspora, simultaneously referencing the Afro-Cuban dance, Mambo, and the term for an Afro-Haitian priestess, also Mambo. While her seductively naked and red-shoed subject wields a deadly African Mamba, that's M-A-M-B-A, snake. And Saar has chosen a women's art form, the sequined Vodun flags of Haiti, as the vehicle for this culturally complex imagery. It's a very dark slide, I'm sorry about this. In recent years, a number of black women have produced work dealing with questions of identity. For example, Howardina Pindell's 1980 video performance, Free, White, and 21, describes the harrowing effects of racism and its internalization by black women. Can we focus this a little bit? In contrast, if you can ever make it out, Clarissa Sly's 1987, Who We Was, staunchly refuses the straitjacket of racist misconceptions, turning the mockery of racial stereotyping back on the perpetrators. Two works by Adrienne Piper, her 1981 pencil drawing, Self-Portrait Exaggerating My Negroid Features, and her What Will Become of Me, a duration piece begun in 1985, continue black women's ongoing conversation about identity. They are unusual, however, in being among the few self-portrait images I found in an admittedly random collection of black women artists' slides. The only other self-portrait in my possession was Candace Hill's 1985 Stoneman, which contains the reflected images of the artist at upper right and her daughter near the photo's center. While the assertion of self-conscious identity is probably a development unique to the generation of black women who have come of age with the second wave women's movement, one could argue that the content of the resulting works is not entirely unlike that of Edmonia Lewis's Hagar or Meta Fuller's Ethiopia Awakening. In conclusion, though, I would like to focus upon a pair of images that strike me as being absolutely unprecedented. Clarissa Sly's Lay on Top of Me, here on the left, a 1984 Van Dyke print, and Adrian Piper's 1986 My Calling Card Number 2. The former Sly's piece breaks important thematic ground by focusing on incest, while the latter breaks black women artists' silence about the restriction of female activity via sexual harassment of women who dare venture into public places of amusement without an escort. Although we arrive in new territory with these works' specific themes, they remain tied to the dreams of previous generations of black women artists. Works of protest, they remind us that black liberation will not be complete until black women are free of gender exploitation and domination. Like Edmonia Lewis's Forever Free, carved over a century ago, these works indicate that in the last quarter of the 20th century, black women still face what Sojourner Truth called slavery partly destroyed, not entirely. That's it.
It was in San Antonio, a woman of color.
I'm just wondering what any or all of you think of those kinds of shows, and if you think that that's sort of an adequate response to black women's expression in sort of a museum setting. Or just basically what you think about those kinds of shows.
Had this discussion several times with a good friend of mine, Kelly Jones, where at one point when we were both in school, we said, we're really happy to see it because we need a venue to show our work. And but at this point in history, it's really patronizing, and it's just not a fair way to present our artists. Certainly I prefer to see my work within a larger context and a broader context. That's why in my talk I discussed the Hispanic arts in the United States, the Hispanic art show in the United States, which is at the Brooklyn Museum, by the way. Isn't any longer, it was at one point. It's the only venue right now where we can the only method we can show our work, but it sort of distorts us, and I had someone recently who called me who said to me, she was screaming on the other side of the phone, and she said, It's the first time I'm going to be in a show in Georgia, and it's not because I'm a woman, it's not because I'm a Puerto Rican woman, it's because my work fits in within, you know, the curatorial agenda that this curator has decided to do, and she said, I'm getting the money and I'm flying over there because I have to celebrate, and she said, we have to see more of this, hopefully it'll it'll change. I'm not so sure that's the case.
I would just like to add that, for me, it's a really difficult time, and because as an artist, I feel very self-conscious wherever I show, regardless of whether it's in one of those, you know, so-called minority or strictly of color shows, or whether it's in it's in a different situation, because there's always uncomfortable sense that one way or another you're being used, possibly, you know, and whether you're being tokenized, they want to play up your ethnicity by including you in the show. We need one of those there, you know, or in a different situation where you feel like there's a possibility of being ghettoized in the sense that who is going to come to see this show, who is going to review it, and all the sort of imbalance of power that comes into play. Mm-hmm. However, I guess I would qualify that statement by saying that I do think that special shows where it's specifically, let's say, of color shows, do serve a purpose, and I believe it's more how they're done and who's doing it, and you know, it's never a totally comfortable situation. But I think that, for instance, the couple of the situations I've been in, for instance, of the Coast to Coast Woman of Color show, it was organized by women of color for a woman of color, and the basic power structure and decision making, everything was basically within our own domain, so that I felt that you can't really, there's no level of being used necessarily in that case. And I think that it's still the issue that in terms of the invisibility rather of a lot of artists of color is still so strong that in a way, we need more and more venues to get the work out. And unfortunately, in the case of Asian Americans, I feel that even though we're getting the work out and the work is out there, it's not being documented. And it's not, you know, when you have the officials, institutional people saying, well, we can't find them. And it's because, yeah, if you try to
go through
and find them in the printed matter, we're not there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because we lack the institutional clout. We don't. As compared to, let's say, Latinos or the Black African Americans, I mean, we don't have that level of institutional development, for instance, where we have even a museum level situation that promotes and documents and warehouses and all that our work. So Asian Americans. So that's a whole other level. So a whole other aspect of this. And was that a another panel earlier this morning at the Asian American Arts Center, actually it was concerning the Havana Biennale in particular, but when we, I was addressing the relations, I was addressing Black artists from England and the fact that when we were there, we got into a lot of discussion and dialogue with them, specifically about the issue of racism in the arts. And, you know, one of the things that kept coming up over and over is, well, who is the audience for our work? And the fact that the work may address, you know, aspects of identity and community and so on, and yet oftentimes it's not fully supported by the community economically or in terms of the venue, and it's oftentimes in the white power structure that it gets presented, or, you know, I mean, how many of these discussions are we having where, you know, it's always in sort of a more of a white control situation. And I think if we could sort of get to a situation where these things are also initiated by and somewhat determined by our own communities, that would be really terrific.
Yeah, I guess what I feel about the whole issue of segregated shows is that it is, to me, a double-edged sword, that there are very strong reasons, positive reasons, for doing shows that separate out a group in order to look at it as a group and to see, you know, what it has in common, whether it's in historical terms or strictly aesthetic terms or whatever. But there are also situations in which that, if it is continually perpetuated, yes, indeed, becomes ghettoization.
Mm-hmm.
The other side being that, well, if you are constantly inserting artists of color into mainstream situations, are you then burying that aspect of their work that has to do with their specific ethnic identity,
right,
et cetera, et cetera?
Right.
So I think there are always both of those problems. And to me, the situation is, excuse me, the solution, this is probably rather utopian, is going back and looking at what our assumptions are about art exhibitions, mm-hmm. about art itself. Because I think that part of the reason why this is so much of a question for all of us and why it is so disturbing for all of us is that to one degree or another we've internalized a notion of art as separate from the rest of the social sphere.
Right.
And the minute you break through those boundaries, then it's like, well, you know, why not have women's shows? Why not have, you know, Asian American shows? Uh-huh. Why not have whatever, whatever? All shows in one way or another have some social link or basis, whether it's disguised or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I found the common thread with all of this wire. It's really empowering.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you don't find at the Met, I think, not very much, but a lot of the things, like you had to make a lot of money already, you know, so you have that picture, you had black women with hair. It's really powerful because it's things we're all struggling with and things we're all dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that's why you're getting more problems putting on exhibitions, because this hits people and hurts people more than Monet, you know, for an example. It's going to bother them much more to do that.
That's right.
To
yeah.
be in a situation where you
with
the
art, right? Exactly.
And
yeah.
it seems to me that the shows, the group shows, should be put out there, whether it's groups of Hispanics or groups of Blacks or groups of
mm-hmm.
Asians or groups of women. I don't care about the group, but just put it in our midst.
Within our living
yeah,
environment.
Whoever's
yeah.
in it, just have us in it too. So
mm-hmm.
it's much more important.
Yeah, there is a need to challenge sort of the traditional modes of presenting works of art sort of in a, you know, sacred way, whereas you just frame it and hang it up high in a white wall, and you have to walk in a, you know, through a special corridor, and it's sort of like a, almost like a sort of a religious act, and that doesn't not invite very many people to see art as part of their lives. That, you know, the exhibition ways of the methods or the structures of creating exhibitions, it's been the same for like 80 years and hasn't changed. And there is some rumbling right now of some museum directors and curators just beginning to talk about, you know, why not have new ways of showing work outside on billboards, or having you know, people who are not artists coming and curate shows, and that sort of thing. But it's just talk right now. It hasn't happened yet. Hopefully, maybe we'll begin to see some of that.
There was a question earlier by someone to list where they could track some of the artists, and something that might be of interest. I'm very taken with Lonnie and Lewis's work,
mm-hmm.
and there's going to be a number of pieces
uh-huh.
at the Brooklyn Museum. The show Facing
Good.
History is opening
mm-hmm.
April 25th. If anybody wants to see more of
that. Okay, that's good.
Youngson.
I have read recently the work of Teresa Chan,
We were very close friends, actually, because we were classmates together at Berkeley.
She dead?
Yeah. She was killed in 82, actually, a few months after the publication of her book, Dictée. Is that the book that you were...
Yes, I know.
So it was an act of incredible violence.
Was she in this country?
She immigrated here, I think in her teens, early teens, to Hawaii, then her family settled in San Francisco, and that's been her United States home.
I was struck by the issues that she was dealing with.
I did mention that. Well, the Alternative Museum will be having that exhibition based
on White
Street. On White
Street,
right.
Yeah.
It's
on White Street.
May 5th is the opening.
Also, you're working with the Appearance of the Decade.
That's right.
Oh, that's right.
And that opens in April, right? June.
It's opening in three openings.
Oh, yeah. Margo, why don't you tell us that?
Just in case you want to see more of the works, of many of the artists that were presented today along with appearing at the show, and so the Decade Show is a collaboration with the Studio Museum of Harlem, the New Museum of Contemporary Art, the Museum of Contemporary Hispanic Art. And it's going to be opening, it's a show about ethnic, about identity issues. Many of the people that have spoken to today. There are three openings. The first is May 11th.
Right.
Which is the Ethno New Museum, which is 583 Broadway in Soho. The second one will be on the 15th, which will be at the Museum of Contemporary Hispanic Art, which is across the street from the New Museum, 584 Broadway. I don't know if I should be making money, but he's going.
Right.
See, the third one is on the 17th, May 17th, at the Studio Museum of Harlem. So, it's like a show where the artists involved from all different communities, they're obviously men and women, it's going to be distributed around, so it's not like we went to the studio and there's only artists that are black, it's going to be a mix of people. And part of the idea was to have people show different things that might not necessarily have been shown before. So, that shows the run, I think, through July. But, so if you guys are interested in seeing more, just find out there.
Yeah, that's a good idea. It's going to be a great show.
Also, if you give me your address, I could periodically send you.
Oh, that's a good idea, actually, yeah.
Also, if you send things to the Center for Research on Women here, we distribute.
Oh, distribute to the students. Oh, that's a good idea.
We come through here, we post things, we give out things.
Oh, that's a good idea.
That's another thing. Write and do research and all that. I mean, I know what it's like to find information. And something that I think people sort of outside the art of color circles sometimes don't realize is what the information sources are.
That's right.
For the different art groups. And I would say that of the museum spaces on this list, which would be like the top museum and gallery, non-commercial gallery, the first five institutions that are listed here. All of them are incredible repositories of information about artists of color.
Documentation, catalogs.
Catalogs. They are happy to refer people to artists if they don't have the information themselves. Some of them have archives to one extent or another, etc.
We do need one repository. It'd be really great to have one place where all this.
For African American artists, there is something called the Patch Phillips Collection. They have the largest fly collection.
Is there anything for Asian?
Yeah, for Asian American art, there's Center. Asian American Art Center for one, which is located on 26 Byron Street, just below Canal Street. I would just also like to add that there's a an umbrella organization for Asian American arts and cultural organizations called Asian American Arts Alliance, and we're located at blanking out on Lafayette and Bleecker, and we share a space with what used to be PAD. But Asian American, we have on our rosters over 100 groups, Asian American groups, and most of them are very small, fledgling, community-based organizations. But nevertheless, you know, they exist, and you know, if you get in touch with the alliance, they could pass on information if you want to pursue this further. Mm-hmm.
Isabel, do you know, does Mocha have a side registry at all, or does the Museo del Barrio?
The Museo del Barrio does, not Mocha. Mocha has available in their files, they do have the documentation catalogs that you can look at, that you can borrow as well. Well, I guess that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you.
There is a reception up, what floor are we on? We're on 3 down the hall, around 20. Can you grab a soda or wine?
Then we can have a soda.
Yes.